McCarthy Insurance Group, serving the community for over 70 years. For home, farm, motor, life, health and business insurance, log on to mig.ie or free phone 1800 50 11 11. Probably your best call in 2024. Charles McCarthy Insurance is trading as McCarthy Insurance Group is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Now, real people, real opinions, Nighttime Talk.
Ireland's classic hits radio.
Joining us tonight is Dr. Edward Burke, a historian and author of the recently published book Ghosts of a Family, Ireland's most infamous unsolved murder. In this gripping true crime story, Dr. Burke delves into the brutal 1922 massacre of the McMahon family in Belfast, a case that has haunted Ireland for over a century. Dr. Burke's meticulous research sheds new light on this dark chapter in Irish history, revealing the complex political and social forces that led to this tragic event. You're very welcome to the show, Dr. Burke.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I guess we'll go back to the start and describe for us maybe the circumstances of the McMahon massacre and why you believe it was such a pivotal moment in Irish history.
Sure. So on the morning of the 24th of March 1922, just after 1:20 a.m., a group of men, five men, smashed their way into a house in North Belfast, 3 Kinnaird Terrace, which is owned by a prosperous publican called Owen McMahon. Once inside, they lined up the male members of the household, told them to say their prayers, and they shot Owen McMahon, 4 of his sons, and an employee barman called Eddie McKinney dead. And that really was, you know, it was the near annihilation of a family. It caused outrage not only on the island of Ireland, but also in Britain as well. Winston Churchill called a cannibal in terms of a cannibal in all but the eating, in terms of with an atrocity unequaled elsewhere in Europe in recent times. So it was you know, greeted with complete shock, and then, from the Irish government's point of view, of course, the Anglo-Irish Treaty had just been signed months earlier in December 1921. They believed that it was likely now that they would have to go back to war with the British, that simply that because the British state was unable to stop atrocities of this type in the north of Ireland, that violence was increasing in Belfast to such an extent that there would possibly be a resumption of hostilities against the British state. On the British side, they immediately reacted by summoning Prime Minister James Craig to London, where they ordered Craig's government, the Northern Irish government, to sign an agreement with the provisional government of the Free State, Michael Collins' government, which was known as the Collins-Craig Pact. So for a time, it looked like perhaps that full-scale war would be averted, but of course, the Collins-Craig Pact did not hold. Michael Collins was determined to invade Northern Ireland in the early summer of 1922, and he came up with plans for what he called the Northern Offensive. And that never actually came to fruition, because the National Army, the new army of the Irish state, was more concerned about the imminent outbreak of what became the Civil War. But meanwhile, the IRA, in vengeance for what had happened to the McMahon family, and indeed other atrocities in Belfast, planned the assassination of Field Marshal Henry Wilson. He was the former head of the British Army and a key advisor to James Craig, including about the police, particularly the Special Constabulary in Belfast, who were believed to have carried out the murders of the McMahon family. And so he was shot in late June 1922. That led to an ultimatum then from the British government to the Irish government to suppress the IRA. So that ultimatum, of course, led to the bombing of the forecourts in June 1922 and the outbreak of the Irish Civil War. So the ripple effects were profound, and indeed the intergenerational cost as well for the McMahon family, but also for a number of other people who were affected by the events of that night, were also very significant.
And the McMahons themselves, they were very important people at the time, weren't they?
They were. I mean, the McMahons were very much part of a nationalist elite in Belfast. So obviously, nationalist Catholics in the city were a minority, making up just over 25% of the population. But they did have some political influence. Joe Devlin was the MP for West Belfast. He was, of course, not a Republican. He was not Sinn Féin. He was Irish Parliamentary Party. He was a nationalist. And the nationalist movement, and not least the Ancient Order of Hibernians, who were again the very much the, you know, the people that most Belfast Catholics looked to for influence. They also had, you know, in terms of capital, financial capital, such as insurance or banking. You know, the Hibernians, the nationalists, and people like Joe Devlin, who was a friend of Owen McMahon. These were very much the elite. And McMahon was as well. He was a popular man throughout the city. The family were involved in Glentoran Football Club, which would be predominantly Protestant East Belfast. They donated to the Ulster Prisoner War Fund. So they were popular with many moderate unionists as well in the city. So that's hence the massacre of the family was such an intense shock.
And did the British realise this at the time? And how was it met both over there and here in Ireland?
I think, you know, the political, because the McMahons were the elite, that a lot of the killing in Belfast, I mean, up to this point, I mean, between 1920 and 1922, nearly 500 people were killed in Belfast, 80% of whom were civilians, and the majority of whom were Catholics. And so, but most of that killing had taken place in really small working class areas of North and West Belfast. And so now that the violence had some effect spilled out into the suburbs, that really shocked the kind of, you know, politicians, MPs began to ask, nationalist MPs began to ask, were they going to be next? The question Joe Devlin asked the House of Commons shortly after the McMahon killings. The fact that, you know, it was apparently police who perpetrated this, you know, that the people who were supposed to be responsible for law and order were instead clearly carrying out atrocities, including against some of the most influential people in nationalist Belfast. And so it was the reaction was normally Irish atrocity. To some extent, the British public had become familiar with it. But I think, you know, the very graphic detail of, you know, the women of the McMahon household being shoved into the drawing room, the men and the boys of the family being taken into the dining room, and the fact that, you know, Owen McMahon's youngest son, Michael, who was 11 years old, managed to escape by hiding under a dining room table. Later, he collapsed and fainted at his father and his brother's funerals. So it was these kind of details of what seemed to be a kind of idyllic suburban, you know, a suburban scene that many people in Britain could picture, I think was particularly shocking to the readers of the various daily newspapers in London. So it did lead to a reaction, an awareness that you know, something should be done in Belfast. And for a time, that's what the Secretary of State for the Colonies, Winston Churchill, and others in David Lloyd George's government sought to do. The problem that they faced, though, was that ultimately, you know, the British Army, who had been writing regular reports about how the police were systematically involved in atrocities, particularly the Special Constabulary, this part-time force. Again, there were over 31,000 members of the Special Constabulary in Northern Ireland. They were by far the largest force. The British Army in March 1922 had only 5,000 soldiers in Northern Ireland, and the Royal Irish Constabulary, the regular police, were smaller than that again. So by far, the most dominant force who were under the control of the Northern Irish government was the Special Constabulary. And so the British Army had at various points insisted in September 1921, for example, had disarmed the Special Constabulary in Belfast and ordered them off the streets. But in November 1921, London had transferred powers of policing to the new Northern Irish government, which really had only been established 6 months previously. And this created a chaotic scene where the army was no longer in control of the police in the way that they wanted to be. And it also led to a real uptick in atrocities. Loyalists were extremely scared and anxious about the Anglo-Irish Treaty because they believed that would establish an Irish state, indeed an Irish army, an Irish air force, which would turn its guns against Northern Ireland imminently. So hence there was a serious escalation in loyalist atrocity in early 1922, including by members of the Special Constabulary. And so the British Army had been writing reports saying that you must disband the Special Constabulary, you must investigate these atrocities, otherwise Northern Ireland will be born in an original sin from which it will not recover. But when push came to shove after the McMahon murders, the War Office and the British government of Prime Minister David Lloyd George looked at the estimates of soldiers that they would need to send to Northern Ireland if they were, for example, to demobilise the Special Constabulary or even take on the Special Constabulary, because Special Constables had shot a number of British soldiers who were trying to intervene to stop atrocities that constables were perpetrating in the previous months. Indeed, they killed one soldier in January 1922. And so the numbers, the estimates that the British government believed that they needed, the soldiers that they needed to take from elsewhere in Europe and the Empire after the First World War, were too high. So ultimately, they ducked the challenge and they didn't disband the Special Constabulary and they didn't reform the police. And that had obviously seismic effects for Northern Ireland.
And
Not least because the Special Constabulary in 1969, at the outbreak of the more modern troubles, but that was at the forefront of sectarian violence in Belfast.
Mm. Okay, I'm curious about at the time who they thought was responsible, and how does that line up to who you think is responsible ultimately for the McMahon massacre?
Yeah, so the assessment at the time by some was that it was believed that District Inspector John Nixon may have had a hand in the murder. And this is because John Nixon, who was originally from Cavan, was believed to be a highly politicised loyalist police officer who was in cahoots with loyalist paramilitaries in West Belfast and had a very close relationship with B Specials, with parts of the Special Constabulary that were involved in atrocities. And so it was believed that, in some ways, the Irish government singled him out for particular attention. At the time, actually, Sinn Féin reported that it was the Special Constabulary that perpetrated the McMahon murders. And, of course, D.I. Nixon was a regular police officer. In 1924, the Irish government produced something called the Nixon Memorandum, in which they identified the regular Royal Irish Constabulary, including Nixon, as the perpetrators. But at the time, the IRA and Sinn Féin, and indeed the British Army, all believed that it was the Special Constabulary. So Nixon also doesn't meet the description of the... So there was a number of survivors who had a very good opportunity to look at the features of the leader of the gang, who was the only man dressed in civilian clothes, and then the four other police officers as well. The leader, who was to the Irish government later in the memorandum, the Irish government, there was later allegations that they identified that this man was probably John Nixon. But really, he doesn't really match the features whatsoever of that person. He was far older. He wasn't clean shaven. And he also spoke with a very distinctive soft Cavan accent, whereas the perpetrator, the leader of the gang who killed the McMahons, had a very pronounced Belfast accent. So there's lots of things that didn't really add up in terms of the witness descriptions. And, of course, at the time, the McMahons were under threat because Patrick McMahon, a publican in North Belfast, who I believe to be the brother of Owen McMahon, had been targeted by a loyalist special constable who's also the leader of a paramilitary group called the Ulster Imperial Guards in November 1921. And this man, David Duncan, was responsible for the killing of quite a number of publicans in what was essentially sort of Peaky Blinders, but with a lot more sort of sectarian explosives involved, taking over, extorting Catholic publicans, taking over their bars, etc., taking over businesses. That's very much what loyalist paramilitaries were doing at the time, particularly in the York Road, York Street area, Antrim Road area of North Belfast. David Duncan was a former soldier. He'd also served in the Russian Civil War, in the British Expeditionary Force there. He was a former auxiliary in the Royal Irish Constabulary, was kicked out for misconduct. And then he was one of the leaders of a paramilitary group called the Ulster Imperial Guards, which was had threatened to overthrow James Craig at one stage, Prime Minister James Craig. And Craig had responded by co-opting them, essentially trying to bribe them by turning them into an elite part of the Special Constabulary, the C1 class, who were better paid, better armed than the rest of the Special Constabulary. Now, his grievance was that, obviously, when he tried to kill Patrick McMahon at his pub on the York Road on 24th of 1921, Patrick McMahon fortunately ducked and managed to escape, but that the McMahons felt that they had enough clout in the city to actually complain to the police and get a conviction against this man. And that was a drastic mistake, because What the Ulster Imperial Guards and the Special Constables did when they were people accused of murder was generally to try and kill witnesses. And so a large number of witnesses were killed or wounded whenever the Royal Irish Constabulary, the regular police, tried to bring charges against these men. And indeed, the police commander in North Belfast, a Catholic police officer called William Lynn, tried successively to get convictions, but almost always failed to do so because of this intimidation and violence towards witnesses. Patrick McMahon seemed to have believed that he could somehow do this and be successful where others had failed. And the trial against David Duncan collapsed in February 1922. Ultimately, District Inspector William Lynn's own sergeant, a guy called William Robb, gave evidence in favour of Duncan and contradicted Lynn. And so the whole trial collapsed, and David Duncan was praised as an upstanding citizen by the judge, etc. Patrick McMahon then had to quickly leave Belfast, and indeed other witnesses also fled the city. Owen McMahon stayed, and of course David Duncan then was a man very much with a grievance towards the wider McMahon family. He also was suffering from serious mental health issues at this time. He's later diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic who reacted extremely violently to any setbacks. So, you know, he's a man with a propensity for violence. He's mentally unwell. I believe that he is the man with the motive, the opportunity and the means by which to murder the McMahon.
And what were the biggest challenges you faced in uncovering the truth behind the murders? And what sources did you rely on? Because it's a long time ago, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a long time ago. And of course, the criticism from former First Minister and Nobel Peace Prize winner David Trimble was always that, you know, historians, particularly in the south of Ireland, had always relied on IRA sources to sully the name of the police in Belfast. And anyway, that's a serious point to make, you know, in terms of certainly, you know, the IRA was obviously very antipathetic to the RIC and indeed the RUC and the Special Constabulary. So I tried my best to look for other sources because to see if there was other traces. And indeed, the Northern Irish government, I did identify John Nixon as a man who was colluded with loyalist paramilitaries, who was involved in murder. But they, and like the IRA at the time, believed that John Nixon was very careful never to be at the scene of a murder. So he may have covered up for those who were involved in murder. He may even have commissioned murder from time to time. But, you know, both Northern Irish government and indeed the IRA in Belfast in 1922 didn't believe that he would be physically present. Then I sort of found other sources. The British Army's intelligence reports of the period had been closed for 100 years, and I found them in Norwich Castle. Initially, the British Army didn't want them to release the files to me because they were believed to be too sensitive. I appealed that decision and managed to get access to the files. And you know what they certainly showed was, which I think was the sensitivity of them, was a situation where from late 1921, 1922, the British Army was involved in, you know, successive firefights against the police in Belfast, and it killed a number of police officers. In some ways, this is the British Army actually, you know, trying to stop atrocity and protect Catholic areas. So, the fact that they were shooting policemen they were doing it in the course of their duty. So the sensitivity, I think, of these files was exaggerated and overblown. But perhaps, you know, shooting the army shooting the police in the same state is something that is still regarded as embarrassing many years later. So these files kind of, you know, definitely indicated that people like, you know, it gave me a much more forensic view on who the various loyalist gang leaders were, because the British Army were very interested in who the loyalist gang leaders were, because they were shooting at them and killing, you know, they were killing large amounts of Catholic civilians, but they were also, you know, causing military casualties as well. A number of soldiers were shot by police officers. So they were careful to collect this intelligence, and this intelligence then gave a very interesting insight into who was involved in extortion, who was shooting publicans, because the soldiers were obviously in significant numbers, and they were on the streets every day, and they were, you know, they also concluded that John Nixon was involved in murder, but they didn't believe he was involved in murder. They believed his patch was West Belfast, and there were others who were in charge in North Belfast.
The Irish history really is incredibly complex. Why do you think this book helps uncover some things that maybe people have overlooked in the past?
Well, yeah, it is extraordinarily complex. I think because, you know, maybe at the time, sort of 100 years later, to look at it, with, for example, the British Army. I mean, the British Army during the War of Independence period was clearly involved in atrocities in the island of Ireland. So then, you know, you're trying to get your head around the idea that they may be, you know, fighting against loyalists in the street of Belfast. That's a complexity that takes a kind of, you know, you need to look at that in a way that's, you know, you need to allow for a lot of complexity to kind of to balance those two things at the same time. Are the fact that loyalists can often try and force the hand of the British government, you know, that or even that working class loyalists in Belfast can threaten Prime Minister James Craig so that he doesn't compromise with Michael Collins' government and doesn't allow for a boundary commission or doesn't reform the police. Not that Craig particularly wanted to. He was under pressure from the British government, but he was also under pressure from loyalist extremists, and ultimately the loyalist extremists got what they wanted. So again, you know, trying to kind of look at the complexity of Northern Ireland in terms of the, you know, unionism and loyalism is something that is extraordinarily complex. So the British state has these layers. You know, soldiers can shoot police and police can shoot soldiers during this time. And so I think to some extent, you know, if you're not looking for complexity, you won't find it. So hopefully this book kind of appeals to people who want to go a bit further and trying to understand not only the complexity within the British state, within this kind of relationship between the military and the police and loyalist gangs, but also on the nationalist side. I mean, certainly after 1922, there wasn't a lot of appetite in the Irish state, for example, to talk about the Ancient Order of Hibernian ex-soldiers who were involved in the defence of Catholic areas in Belfast or Derry. But yet there were an awful lot of them. They had a paramilitary group called the Hibernian Knights. I managed to get access eventually to some of their files as well, which was very, very, very difficult to look. They were difficult to locate. And the Hibernian, but, you know, the Irish state, of course, Sinn Féin and the IRA had a very, you know, had a very hostile attitude towards the Hibernians, didn't like them. And often there was violence between Hibernians and the IRA in places like Belfast as well. So I think trying to, again, you know, if you're open to complexity about nationalism and you know, you can, if you just follow the easy narratives, which is, of course, and some of these narratives were, of course, you know, the state was interested in capturing IRA memories, but again, they weren't interested in Hibernians. Similarly, the British state doesn't necessarily want to release files about soldiers killing police officers. So I suppose, look, it adds a lot of complexity, but the reality was very complex, and the situation in the North was extraordinarily violent, complex. And I think as well that, you know, for a long time, you know, there wasn't an appetite on the unionist side to maybe look at, you know, the tense relations between some of the unionist leaders and you know, the beat specialist loyalists who were sometimes threatening the government in Belfast. I think similarly in the South, you know, for a long time there was, you know, the sense that the North, nationalists in the North, had, of course, been, you know, there had been, there was a sense of guilt there that the IRA campaign, obviously the IRA headquarters in Dublin had pushed the IRA in Belfast to escalate their campaign of assassinations, of arson against the unionists' own businesses, etc. And this had precipitated such an extreme backlash. And then when the Northern Offensive was supposed to happen, it didn't happen. And so to some extent, some of the promises to Northern Nationalists have been, of course, not been fulfilled. And many Northern Nationalists, including witnesses who were involved in court cases, had to flee the North. Some of them joined the National Army and were involved, indeed, in the Civil War. So I think there was a sense of guilt there, a sense of guilt that didn't go away.
Well, it's a fascinating read, I have to say, and a totally gripping book. And I think an important one for anyone who lives on the island of Ireland to have a read of. Ghosts of a Family, Ireland's Most Famous Unsolved Murder, The Outbreak of the Civil War and the Origins of Modern Troubles. Dr. Edward Burke and Your Young Child, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks a million. Good night to you.
Now, real people, real opinions, Nighttime Talk.
Ireland's classic hits radio.